Hello, and welcome to this season's first episode of Argus News Radio, a weekly look at news, life, and culture at Wesleyan University and beyond. Argus News Radio is produced in collaboration with WESU and The Argus, Wesleyan's student-run newspaper. I'm Mary Longley, here with some headlines for you for this Tuesday, February 2nd. A new proposal from the university's finance office would cut funding for the library's acquisition budget. The budget normally increases annually by 5%, but under the new plan, this increase would drop to 3%. Already, the acquisition funds have been reduced by 10% this year. The acquisition budget covers books, subscriptions to journals, newspapers, periodicals, and special collections. In order to continue expanding and keeping the library up to date on the smaller allowance, fewer physical books would be purchased, but more online and electronic resources would be made available. If passed, the financial office's measure would take effect in the fall and would continue through 2020. A formal vote on the matter will not take place until the Board of Trustees meets in May. Associate Director of Wesleyan Fire Safety, Barbara Spalding, bid farewell to campus after 5 years of employment. According to the Associate Vice President for Facilities, Spalding's position was eliminated at the close of last semester. Spalding began several initiatives on campus, including making it necessary to install sprinklers in all student residences. Spalding also started the West Home program, which teaches upperclassmen about the fire hazards of living in wood frame houses. She also pushed for the fire inspection of every residence on campus and for increasing fines on violations of the fire code. Although no reasons have been given for why the position was removed, officials make it clear that there have been no changes made to fire safety policies on campus. It looks like the demolition and environmental cleanup of the former Long Lane School on Long Lane in Middletown is causing the state of Connecticut a financial headache. Even after reimbursing Wesleyan University $2 million, the state of Connecticut will still owe Wesleyan an additional $14 million, according to the agreed stipulations in Public Act 99-26. The university purchased the state-owned property in 2000 on the condition that the state would reimburse all costs associated with bringing the 160-acre parcel up to code. The site is currently used for athletic fields, including softball and rugby, as well as providing space for physical plant. The university will receive the $2 million within 1 to 2 months after the commission's approval. There is not yet a specific timeline in place for the additional cost to be repaid. In efforts to gain an understanding and create a better awareness of homelessness in Connecticut, 10 teen groups from local churches spent the night outside. Last Saturday evening, the groups gathered for a pre-sleep-out dinner before staying outdoors from 6 p.m. until sunrise. Temperatures dropped below 10 degrees, but the teens stayed out in solidarity. The project was intended to teach some of the challenges that those living without a home face daily. And Wesleyan University has responded to a lawsuit brought by Dr. Stephen L. Morgan. Dr. Morgan is charging the university with 3 counts of defamation, 2 counts of false light invasion of privacy, and 1 count of emotional distress. Dr. Morgan, a Cornell professor, was mistakenly associated with the killing of Johanna Justin Jinnick after his photograph was posted online in lieu of the actual suspect who shares the same name. The university's attorney, Michael C. Harrington, has responded to Dr. Morgan's claims by stating that the photo was posted in the interest of protecting students. The university also claims that the photo's publication was limited. Although Wesleyan has denied most of the allegations in Dr. Morgan's suit, it has admitted to publishing the professor's photo on a university website and in an email sent to the community. That's it for today's headlines. Next, we'll hear from Argus News Radio correspondent Cora Engelbrecht about some of the relief efforts happening on campus with regards to the disaster in Haiti. To gain some insight, Cora sat down with a member of the Haiti Relief Action Team, which is a student group recently organized on campus.
Hello, I'm Cora Engelbrecht. It has now been about 3 weeks since the devastating earthquake occurred in Haiti. And over this course of time, it has become clear that students, as well as local community members, are determined to not let the Haiti travesty fade from the spotlight. Over the past 2 weeks, Middletown local employees have participated in 2 Dress Town Days. After donating to a charity for Haiti relief, workers have had the option of dressing down to a t-shirt and blue jeans or sprucing their style with a tuxedo or dinner dress. Overall, approximately 40 town employees participated and succeeded in raising $521. On Thursday, there will be a lecture presented by faculty in the CFA addressing Haitian history and culture. The lecture will be followed by a panel discussion led by Wesleyan professors Alex Dupuy, Elizabeth McAllister, and Gina Ulis. One of the leading proponents in jumpstarting relief efforts across campus is the Haiti Relief Action Team. The team organizers have been working with students to find ways in which students can collaborate and contribute to the cause. I'm here now with one of the team's organizers, Sabine. Hi, Sabine.
Hello.
So, before we get into how you've been working with the Relief Action Team, can you tell us a bit about your personal connection to Haiti? I understand both your parents are Haitian.
Both my parents were born and raised in Haiti. My family members go back all the time. I unfortunately haven't had the chance to go back yet. Just never really had the opportunity or the time to do it. I've been surrounded by Haitian family members my entire life. I feel, identify as Haitian American.
And you have family and extended friends that are in Haiti now?
Yeah, I have extended family that are there. My aunt and my godson actually came back the day before the earthquake, so I'm, really grateful for that. Lots of aunts and uncles, cousins, my parents' friends, and my brother and my sister were born there, so they have a lot of friends that they're looking for and they're concerned about.
And have they been in contact with any of these?
Yeah, some of them have. I have a cousin who lost a lot of her school friends. So she's she's in mourning right now, and she's just really upset. And that's how it is for a lot of people right now.
So in terms of you getting the relief team together, you sort of banded together pretty quickly. How did that happen exactly?
The day it happened, I emailed Tim Shiner about putting on an event at Beckham. Mm-hmm. And I think the same night or the next day, Jonna, she texted me, and she was like, what do you think of putting, a team together? Because a lot of people are going to want to put on events to raise money and help out. And what if we just had, this team, to kind of organize things and kind of get the information out there? And I was down to do it. So.
Wow, that's good. Can you talk a little bit about the team members, how you've been splitting up responsibility?
Jonna had the idea to do a concert. She was working with, I think, Amanda Contrada. We also wanted to a discussion to kind of also talk about what's going on in Haiti and the history and, just a lot of different things about Haiti. Mm-hmm. And so those are the three events, the formal that I wanted to do, the concert and the discussion. And so, since I was already working on the formal, I kind of stuck to the formal. Uh-huh. Jonna and Amanda are doing the concert, and Pedro, I believe he's kind of coordinating the discussion, as well as Amanda Herrera. Mm-hmm. They've kind of been doing that.
Now, the dinner, that's going to be this Saturday, right?
Yeah, it's a formal, it's more of a party, I would say, than a sit-down dinner. There'll be food, there'll be tables, there's going to be a DJ, there's going to be some bands.
Right.
So it's more of a celebration of Haitian culture. I really wanted to. The news was really frustrating because all they ever said, Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
Right,
I was tired
of
hearing that over and over again. And there are lots of things I'm proud about. And food and music, it's not the only thing that Haiti has to offer. But, I mean, those are two things that are easily accessible to people. So I wanted to put this party together to kind of celebrate Haitian culture with people that haven't experienced it and for people that, know it and love it. Mm-hmm. But I do recognize a lot of Haitians in the community aren't ready to party. They're still in mourning, so it's kind of more for everybody who hasn't experienced it. I think they should come out and try some food, dance to some music, and just have a good time. And
And who's going to be performing at the dinner?
There's a band. I forgot what they're called. It's a friend of mine is putting that together. And then
there's going to be a DJ.
There's going to be a DJ, and then there's another local band from Connecticut. I believe his name is Mac Jean.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the works of trying to get him to come and perform, but that's not definite yet. But hopefully he gets to do it. So
And I know when I was at the committee meeting, you were talking about collaborating with some local groups as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm working with a girl that goes to Central Connecticut State. She's the president of the NAACP over there, and she's also Haitian. I knew her from church years ago.
Uh-huh.
And so she's selling tickets there, and she's kind of getting the word out, and they're getting a guest list together for students from that school that want to come over.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Haitian community center in Stamford, where I'm from, which is in Connecticut, and I was doing some organizing things down there before I came back to school. And a lot of people from down there are coming up for this event as well. So yeah, I'm just using my resources, people that I know.
Great.
Nearby.
Great. All right, well, thank you so much for joining us, and my deepest condolences for the loss and trauma you've been enduring.
Thank you.
And really good luck with putting all of this together.
Thanks. I just want to say there's an event this Thursday also with Gina Ulise that students should go to, or anybody should go to. I believe it's in the CFA hall.
Right.
They're suggesting a $3 donation, and I think food will be served afterwards. She's performing, and there's a discussion afterwards. Okay. So that's this Thursday.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Those are Wesleyan students Cora and Sabine discussing the relief efforts on campus being organized for Haiti.
Are you looking for a creative way to meet new people, stay active, or indulge your imagination? Then come check out Wesleyan University's Green Street Arts Center in Middletown. Classes are offered for all ages and levels, and special programs including Green Street After School and Early Childhood Family Classes, in addition to programs for teens, adults, and seniors. Find out more information at greenstreetartscenter.org or by calling 860-685-7871.
In your community, there are children that play kickball, basketball, football, hide-and-seek, and other games outside after school. When you speed down the road, acting like it's a racetrack, you put these kids in risk for injury or worse.
And we have seen it happen to one of our friends. One of our friends chased a ball into the street and was hit by a driver who was going too fast to stop. When you're driving a residential area, please be aware and alert.
This has been a message from the youth of Middletown.
Peace out.
Next up is ANR contributor Ezra Silk in an interview with Mira Bardwaj. She'll talk about her art history thesis on Indian art.
The Bhagavata Purana paintings reflect the Bhagavata Purana text, which is sort of like a canonical text or a liturgical text, which is on the level of the Christian Bible. And the Gita Govinda paintings reflect the devotional poem of the Gita Govinda, which is on the level of, you know, Paradise Lost in comparison to the Christian Bible. So what I'm trying to understand is the differences that occur between the paintings and the texts, because the text of the Bhagavata Purana claims that Krishna loves everyone equally, whereas the devotional poem of the Gita Govinda claims that Krishna has a one consort, Radha, and that while Krishna does give his love to everyone, his main love is this single figure, Radha. And what's interesting is that the paintings created in the 1780s in Kangra, both the Bhagavata Purana and the Gita Govinda, reflect Krishna having a single love, Radha, as opposed to the paintings reflecting their individual texts appropriately.
So from what I understand, Krishna is this ladies man, and in the original Bible-like text, and he decides in this new poem, this new interpretation, that one of his women he's going to elevate to his consort, and this pretty much changes, at least by this new poem, this changes the way people think about their relationship to him, to God.
Yeah, that's sort of one way of putting it. But I wouldn't say that Krishna is the one making the decision. I would say it's more so the followers within the Vishnu or Krishna worshiping religion that sort of decide that Krishna should have a female consort following this larger change within Hinduism, which is the Bhakti movement and the Shakti movement. The Shakti movement being that every male god has a female consort, and without that female consort, the male cannot have the same power that he always has. And the Bhakti movement being that of devotion, and really it's these followers of Krishna employing Radha as a means of having a devotional experience with the god. It's through Radha's loving experience with Krishna and loving experience and separation from Krishna that followers of Krishna really get to have or experience the full religion. And this is on the rise, in like the 5th to 10th century of the Common Era.
But this is not exactly elevating women, right?
No, it's not.
Their role in society.
A long time ago, you could sort of say that the Bhakti and the Shakti movements were a response that Hinduism had to Jainism and Buddhism being formed and attracting more women to their ranks because Jainism and Buddhism gave women greater power within the religion. So, I mean, initially, you could say that, you know, male gods needing a female consort was a response to the power that Buddhism and Jainism gave to women. However, I think this response within Kangra in the 1780s to have a female consort for Krishna and to accept that female consort is more so out of a need to follow this devotional movement and to have a vicarious experience through Radha with Krishna.
And so basically as a follower of this interpretation, you as a devout Hindu are supposed to imitate Radha, his consort, in that she loves that he is that she is Krishna's object of desire, basically.
Yeah, sort of. It's through viewing these paintings or from reading the texts of the Gita Govinda that you have this experience, this intimate relationship with a god.
So it's more focused on you're loving him as opposed to following his rules?
Sure, yeah. That's one way to view it. It is definitely a bit more about the way that you love him and the way you interact with him than it is about, you know, following his rules or following specific rituals.
And this is the interpretation that eventually took over. Do you know when that happened, when it started
sure.
to take over?
Yeah, so the Gita Govinda, well, to start off, the Bhagavata Purana, the biblical-like text, was created sometime between 500 to 900 of the Common Era. And the Gita Govinda, the devotional poem, was written in the 12th century. So it's really after this devotional poem was written that Radha starts to become popular and two sects within Vishnu or Krishna worship grow and decide to put Radha into the spotlight. So yeah, it's really around the 12th century that, you know, Radha really begins to gain eminence within the Krishna worshipping religion.
And yeah, this is what people still believe in today.
Yeah, I mean, it's widely accepted that, you know, Radha is Krishna's love and consort. And I mean, Hinduism is a huge religion, and it's so ancient and old, and it's morphed and changed with the time.
How many people follow?
I don't know. It's okay, definitely, yeah. I mean, the population of India is, what, almost like about a billion? But
yeah.
Not every single person living in India is a Hindu, but I guess
majority.
You could say the majority of India is Hindu, and also if you're going to include people living in diaspora, I don't know. I guess you can say it's close to a billion. It's one of the largest religions in the world.
Wow.
And it's one of the oldest. And so if you're going to talk to a Hindu, yeah, they might agree that Radha is Krishna's one love, but her relationship specifically, whether she was having an illicit affair with Krishna, whether she was married to Krishna, that may change. It really, like, the specifics may change, but the big idea is what's accepted.
One of the interesting things you're looking at is that these paintings basically violate the original scripture. They say things that are not in the Bible-like text, which points to something interesting about Hinduism, which you said that basically you can interpret it. Lots of people interpret it sort of however they want.
Yeah, I guess that, you know, the Bhagavata Purana, when it was created, you know, Krishna really didn't have a female consort, and it wasn't really that important. His relationship to a female was not necessary for him to become popular. Whereas eventually, as, you know, other gods began to take on female consorts as well, it became much more popular for Krishna to have a female consort named Radha. In fact, she was actually appropriated from a local tribal goddess. But, you know, it really, the deviation from the biblical text in the pictures is a result of this change or this new acceptance within the religion, as opposed to, it's not so much like a violation of the original text as in a following the current spirit of Hinduism of that time.
And with that, we've come to an end of this episode of Argus News Radio. Thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in every Tuesday at 2:30 to WESU 88.1 FM Middletown to hear the show. And you can always catch the show after the fact on the Argus website at wesleyanargus.com. The sky behind you.